Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, infographics, energy drink coupons, or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast. And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Bert. Sorry.
Oh, you know what? That actually might work. Bert. I like that.
Hey, everybody. This is Bert. And today is June 7th. And this episode begins a short discussion series built around the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. For those of you who have listened to a lot of the Free Domain Radio call-in show, you're probably somewhat familiar with this. It's discussed pretty frequently there. I'm really, really excited to welcome Wes Bertrand of CompleteLiberty.com and Matt Amberson of DeadEasyLife.com into the co-hosting chairs for every episode in this series. Great to have Wes back. It was really, really nice to have Matt on the show for the first time, and I look forward to working with him much more in the future. Now, there's just a little something I'd like to interject here. Those of you who are not in our Facebook group don't know anything about this. Recently, School Sucks Project, and some of its past and current participants, namely Daryl Becker, came under attack for the promotion of nonviolent communication. And it was suggested that NVC is a form of mind control, and we are using mind control to manipulate people. And the participants in this Facebook thread who are opposed to NVC ranged from reasonable to highly not reasonable. But the whole incident got me thinking a little bit, and I want to say this. I think a lot of us listen sometimes to podcasts in a fairly passive state. Not all the time, but sometimes. You know, we throw a podcast on while we're driving, or while we're at the gym, or while we're trimming the hedges. And if you're saying, what do you mean trim the hedges? I suggest you check your front yard. Your hedges are probably way out of control at this point, if this has never even occurred to you to do. Or whatever. I listen to podcasts while I'm walking, but my mind can wander. I would really, really make a sincere recommendation that people try to stay especially alert during these shows. And through these discussions that you're going to hear, or through the clips that supplement those discussions, there are no blanket prescriptions for the listenership of this show as a whole. My primary goal here for you, I pursue a show like this, a series like this, with many personal goals in mind. But the goal for the audience is really just to think about what's presented and decide if this is useful for you and decide if there's some follow-up actions you'd like to explore. And I really hope many of you will share these concepts with others. The concept of the inheritance of trauma generation to generation. And, of course, the importance of finding ways to break that cycle. Now, there's many people, I'm sure, in this audience who already know whether or not they have an ACEs score and what it is, and we try to keep you in mind during these discussions as well. We talk a lot about how to build off the basic knowledge that the ACEs provides and some other paths to self-discovery that Matt and Wes have found helpful. A lot of these discussions are quite personal in nature, so I want to say a very sincere thanks to Matt and Wes for their willingness and their openness here. I feel like this is a long overdue exploration for School Sucks, and I hope these discussions have a great benefit for you. So let's get started.
Hello, I'm Pete Gerlach. I've been a professional therapist for 31 years. And during that time, I have become a specialist in working with people who are survivors of childhood trauma. What I mean by that is very young children who were originally abused, abandoned, and neglected by their adults, and as a result, suffered up to 6 significant psychological wounds that strongly affect the quality of their lives and their relationships and their health. So I've been studying that for 19 years. I am such a person myself, so I'm talking from the inside out, as well as having worked with well over 1,000 people who are struggling to improve their lives, their relationships, and their families. One of the things I've noticed along the way, and other colleagues of mine have noticed the same thing, is that many people who survived significant early childhood trauma don't know it. They are unaware of what happened to them and what it has meant. So, the purpose of this video is to ask you a question and then explore your answer. The question is, did you have a normal childhood? How do you know? That really depends on how you define normal. Why do many of us who were significantly abandoned, abused, and neglected by our well-meaning adults, why do so many of us think that our childhood was normal and that our childhood family was average and okay? Why is that if it wasn't really the case? There are at least five reasons. The first is the normal human capacity to blank out psychologically painful circumstances. If your childhood was significantly painful, one way of surviving that was to do something that can be called protective amnesia. Do you know people who, quote, can't remember much of their childhoods? Could that be true of you? Often, people who were significantly hurt as young children and bewildered and confused and lost and abandoned don't remember. That's protective amnesia. The second reason is simple ignorance. I don't mean stupidity. I mean lack of knowledge. Children don't know what abuse is. They don't know what abandonment is. They don't know what parental neglect is. They interpret those traumatic environmental factors as normal. That's all they know. This is how life is. They don't question it. Even if they see friends who are in a better situation, they often don't compare and say, gee, I'm in a dysfunctional family. Kids don't know enough to do that. Another factor in some families, not all, some parents drill into their kids, and churches do this too, respect your parents. So if parents do hurtful things, often children feel significant guilt and shame if they feel critical of their parents. That's painful, and they may want to forget or mute that pain, and they may, quote, not remember it. They may deflect from it. So feeling guilty and ashamed, and feeling guilty about feeling guilty, is another reason that many of us who were traumatized think, oh no, my childhood was normal, it was average. Another composite reason that's very common was first brought to the public's attention in a very useful book, which I still recommend, by Dr. Claudia Black, who is a specialist in children of addicted parents. She proposed that in typical families of such parents, children were taught implicitly, don't talk. Don't talk about what you see. Don't talk about what you feel. And don't ask, by the way. Don't ask any questions. Right? Don't trust. Don't trust that people are going to be there for you because they probably won't. Don't trust your own feelings because you're probably wrong. Don't trust. And another rule that Dr. Black pointed out was don't feel. Don't feel anything. Don't feel what you're feeling. Don't trust your feelings. Don't talk about your feelings. Just accept what is. Those three rules combined, don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel, are incredibly powerful at obliterating children's awareness that they are growing up in a family that's not working well and is not filling their developmental needs. So these reasons all add together. Amnesia, childhood ignorance, guilt over faulting your parents as being, quote, bad people or bad parents, and these three family rules all combine to cause significantly wounded, psychologically wounded people to convince us that our childs were normal, average, and unremarkable, and that, well, yeah, we've got problems, but we're okay. And our parents were pretty good, they're okay. When in fact, the answer was, we were significantly traumatized. We are significantly wounded psychologically, and we're unaware of some very important things. And our lives are stressed frequently and chronically in ways that can be prevented once we acknowledge our childhood trauma. The point here is not to blame your ancestors or your parents. They did the best they could. They also are survivors of childhood trauma, because such trauma passes down the generations until somebody spots it, admits it, and breaks it.
So this is really exciting. I'm very pleased to welcome back Wes Bertrand. Hey, Wes.
Howdy.
And for the very first time, and hopefully not the last, Matt Amberson, thanks for joining us.
A lot of pressure for a rookie.
We tried to make it a high-pressure situation, hot lights, no air conditioning. Since you're new, I thought we'd learn a little bit about you first. You have a blog called deadeasylife.com, and your background's really interesting as well, as in addition to what you're doing now in New Hampshire. You've been here for about a month, so can you tell us a little bit about the blog and then a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I was a California boy, much like Wes, and came up to New Hampshire just recently with my wife and two children that we unschool. I have listened to both of your podcasts quite a bit, and I'm very appreciative. So the first thing I want to do is thank you, Brett. And Wes, I've already thanked you on your podcast.
You did. Thank you.
So I'm here largely from what you guys did, and so I really appreciate it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in the mainstream for many years. I started listening to Free Domain Radio was how I kind of switched off and switched into this world of self-knowledge, and it's culminated, I would say, in my blog where I wanted to communicate some of the things that I'm, much like what Brett said earlier, try to make it easier for people. I consider myself a regular guy to distill down to what's important to me and communicate it out. I'm very lucky to have married a great woman and have two great kids, and we're unschooling and having a great time. So I want to communicate what I've done and how I've changed, and that's the background for the fledgling site that I've started recently.
Awesome. Dead Easy. And Dead Easy, isn't that an acronym?
Okay. I use acronyms quite a bit, and it didn't take very long. So it stands for Life's Ideal Fundamental Ethics. Mm-hmm. Are don't ever aggress and do everything agreed and stated by you. So mm-hmm. If everyone lived like that, I think we'd do a lot better around.
Absolutely.
Now, I thought because I was so curious about the title. I thought Wes was joking there for a second. The title is an acronym. So give us one more.
One more acronym?
Yes.
I have plenty.
Yeah.
Right.
What do you think would be the most relevant one for what we're going to do today?
The most relevant one is ask because we act. Acquire self-knowledge because we're always communicating trauma.
So we learn about ourselves by being honest with ourselves and others about what our experiences have been and how they've shaped us, essentially.
Yeah, we are communicating trauma constantly. It's biasing what we're doing.
Yeah.
When, as friends, we should notice other friends doing these things. And if you acquire self-knowledge by learning more about yourself, listening to these shows, doing therapy, your biases should be reduced and you should be more rational. That's what I mean by that.
Absolutely. And the way I said it, there was no way to turn it into an acronym either. Thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate you sharing that. I appreciate you being here. I'm glad the work that we've done has been a positive influence. That takes us to you, sir, Wes.
Yes, live in studio. It's pretty cool having a new studio, Brett.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Posted some pics on Facebook, the evolution of the studio.
Yeah, and of course, thanks for your help. You moved the heaviest thing in this room.
This table is hefty.
To where it now sits.
It's solid. I think it's bulletproof too, right?
It should be. Well, the legs are anyway, for sure. I just wanted to, before we talk about some of the things that you've done that I certainly want to make people aware of, my story, Matt, I started with Free Talk Live, maybe 2005, 2006. That was my introduction to libertarianism. Also went the Alex Jones route a little bit. I was an angry 29-year-old man, and I was really excited about taking this new knowledge, this new moral and intellectual superiority that I had gained from a basic understanding of libertarianism, and going up to people and stabbing them with it, essentially. And then, I found this better metered individual who was, reading his audiobook, Complete Liberty. And I'm glad I found you when I did, because that helped me acknowledge a lot of, why am I doing this? Why am I taking this new information that could be so useful and trying to use it to start fights with people, then hammer them with intellectualism.
It works for some people, but most people kind of get put off by that, don't they?
It makes good media. That's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, from there, I was also led to Steph. And then you and I started working together the end of 2008.
Did a series, episodes 46 through 51, about education.
Yep. And I got the podcasting bug. And then School Sucks spun off of Complete Liberty in 2009, we could say.
Yeah. It's been a fun journey. Yeah. I just basically closed off my output of episodes, at least of the show, Complete Liberty Podcast.
Yeah.
I'm actually releasing as a podcast, just like the first 10 episodes were Complete Liberty, the book, the audiobook. These episodes, the next three, I've already posted six, the first six chapters of Complete Liberty Inside Out, which is the new book. And so I think everything ends with the show at episode 221. So episodes 213 through 221 are the audiobook to Complete Liberty Inside Out. So it's bookends, basically.
Right.
You get an audiobook at the beginning and the end, and you see, if you listen to all of those shows, that there's an evolution in my thinking, in my presentation about these ideas. Because, you know, if you've dabbled in the Liberty movement, you know there's a lot of moralistic judgment going on. You know, people are frustrated and terribly disappointed at the lack of progress towards freedom. Once you get the freedom bug, you're like, we need to have this. You know, I remember reading books about anarchism, individualist anarchism in the 1800s, like Lysander Spooner, for instance, when I was doing research for the Psychology of Liberty, because I wanted to kind of like write a comprehensive thing that melded Ayn Rand's ideas of philosophy and Nathaniel Brannan's ideas of psychology and be consistent about the idea of anarchism, right? Anarcho-capitalism, which objectivism really hasn't integrated, it doesn't seem like. I mean, there's a few people, like we were talking earlier, in, say, the Atlas Society, David Kelly's organization, that are anarcho-capitalists, I guess, explicitly. But for the most part, they still believe in the idea of government. So why is this? Why is there this belief that we need a coercive organization, an authoritarian system, to tell us what to do and to punish us if we don't do what they say, if we don't abide by, quote, laws, you know? So this led me down this path of psychological understanding. You know, my background is in psychotherapy, so I always had one foot in that realm, even as I was talking about political philosophy, because I think it all goes back to the psyche, to our minds and how we relate to others. And it turns out that this topic we're talking about today, adverse childhood experiences, bears on all of this, because the way that we're introduced to the ideas in the world is through a family system, by and large. And how much thinking have those family members done about these ideas, you know, and how much have they looked at their own childhoods? So there's a lot of this intergenerational transfer. And so in Complete Liberty Inside Out, I cover all of the psychological side of freedom and look into the family, look into our childhoods and discover what needs to be discovered. You have the book, The Art of Self-Discovery, on there. And that's a wonderful process to get empathetically connected with yourself in ways that maybe have been overlooked or neglected over the years.
We've said
and
a lot.
People should get over there and listen to that book or read that book. It's going to be available on Kindle and Audible.
It is on Kindle right now. Yeah. It's on Audible, and it's also in print edition on CreateSpace, which is, it's like the trifecta of the Amazon services there.
Yeah.
So
it's good. Congratulations.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I've gotten through three chapters of it so far. And, you know, one of the really important reiterations, something that you've talked a lot about on your show, something that you just mentioned, I've talked a lot about on my show. You know, we start, and we're not the only two people who are talking about this, thank goodness. It starts in these families. And, you know, after just a few years of being shaped by that environment, we head off to these schools. And those places seem to make perfect sense based on what we've experienced so far. 18 years later, we're out in the world. And suddenly, you know, if we've got a day in court, say, or we've got to pay a tax bill, that relationship with this, you know, authoritarian state makes perfect sense. Yep. And we go from there and we pass it along to the next generation. And, you know, in some ways we see progress, and in some ways we see the opposite. You know, there's things to be encouraged about. There's things that are very troubling about what's going on right now. But yeah, getting to this root, I mean, and that's really what I thank you and Stefan Molyneux for, is a a real priority. And I don't want to say that if people choose to focus on other things like, you know, the Federal Reserve or some other aspect of moving the ideas of liberty forward, I don't want to use language like they're wasting their time. But, you know, I was actually, speaking of Steph, I realized it was about 5 years ago that I had him on my show to talk about heroism. Mm. And in the intro to that show, I set up this model of the areas of influence in our lives. And I might not have been the person who came up with it, but it was useful for me. You know, we have ourselves, the place where we have the most control, and beyond that, our relationships, and beyond that, maybe, you know, our family of origin, and beyond that, our community, and maybe beyond that, the political state. A lot of us learn the ideas of liberty and we jump to the furthest place away from where we have any control.
Right, politics.
You know, yeah. I was saying to Matt before you got here, it's like realizing your basement is flooded, mm-hmm. and you say, okay, well, I'm going to deal with this, but I would feel much better dealing with this. I'd be much more energized to deal with the flooded basement if I just did one trip to space first.
Yeah.
And a lot of people get stuck there. A lot of people get burnt out there. You know, I listened to 31-year-old me or 32-year-old me say, you know, this is really the model that we have to use. But here I am 5 years later, and I find that I'm still very much in that first circle. You know, I'm still working on myself, and I still have a lot of work to do on myself. And I think, you know, given our current situation, given our current culture and the current political condition, it might be worth at least contemplating, if not accepting, the idea that this might be the only real liberation work that most of us get to do in our lives. You know, our age range is 51 to 37 at this table.
Wes is 51?
Kurzweil's older than all of us, though. But he's taking like 50 pills a day, I guess, to ensure his indefinite lifespan.
Yeah, maybe if you can hang on 20 more years, you'll get another 100. I've heard things like that. And that would be great. And maybe that gives us more opportunities to see more things. But even if we were all going to live for hundreds of years, I mean, I think for most of us, certainly for somebody who's had my experiences in life, most of life would be spent doing this self-liberation work.
Absolutely. No matter what age we're living in. What age we are. By the way, Matt, I'm 77. I live in the anti-aging zone. So it's a great book, actually, by Barry Sears, The Anti-Aging Zone. Lower cortisol levels, lower your free radical damage, lower your insulin levels, and lower your blood glucose levels. It's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, lower cortisol sounds nice to me.
No, but I remember that hearing that live, the concentric circles, and that had an impression on me. Thanks. That was very interesting. And when you mentioned today, you start with yourself, and that's the point in the concentric circle. That's what people see.
Yeah.
If you're going to influence people, work on that dot in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about the nature of the show, and we'll probably add this all in, but the discomfort that people feel about broaching these issues, even in politics, you know, it's like somebody threw a turd in the punch bowl when you talk about anarchism.
You know? Right, yeah.
It depends on the context, obviously. I mean, a lot of libertarian functions now are predominantly people who advocate consistent freedom, which means the abolition of slavery, the state, right? So we're not using coercion anymore. But there's different aspects of, like, the punishment system, right? People accept that as the MO, essentially, of how you exact some semblance of justice, that you need to punish the wrongdoers. And where does this come from? Well, it comes from how we lived in our family systems. When we did things that were bad or wrong, were we punished? How were we dealt with, you know?
Or were we rewarded? Because those are the only two things that most people ever hear of. And I just said this in the last show. We put together, me and a listener who has Jeff Till, he has a blog called 500years.org, and he put together 54 reasons for home education. And we talked about 12 on the show, you know, talking about what this does to a child's self-esteem, or the impact that this can have on a child's self-esteem, when it's all just this carrots and sticks. And there's no attempt to connect. There's no empathy. It's just like, were you good or were you bad? Is it carrot or is it stick? Because what else could there be?
And you're supposed to do what you're told.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so, there's a nobility in doing what you're told and working hard to please others.
Because if we're really authentic about the nature of that, we feel some discomfort about addressing the truth, you know?
How do you mean?
Well, the truth can be scary when we know that it's probably going to trigger upset in others, or at least their own discomfort.
Right? Yeah.
So they're less likely to really be curious about what we're saying, less likely to integrate the knowledge that we've come across. You know, that's the real dismay, I think, for a lot of liberty lovers, is that they talk about these ideas to people who aren't versed in them, and they don't really get the curiosity they're wanting, they're looking for. So they don't see the evolutionary process in other people. Why is that?
I remember the struggle for me. Like, goes back to me. I was painting houses and listening to your audiobook.
It was
like the end of 2007, beginning of 2008. And I was like, yeah, anarchism, yeah, but what about the Ron Paul campaign?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Like,
he really might pick up momentum. He really might be able to do this and then get elected and do the things. It was a different time for me.
Right.
It was almost a decade ago. I feel like I'm part of me is like rising up to defend.
Exactly. But right, to try to understand the context of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. But eventually I had to admit, yeah, you're an anarchist, Brett.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, right? In all the family system and, you know, the schooling system, the social systems that we're in.
At the time, it meant I was exiled from every rational, air quotes, political conversation that I had participated in previously, you know?
Exiles. We're going to get into that too, yeah. Right?
What the label, you know, we were, I think, talking again almost a decade ago with a lot more labels maybe than we would try to use today. So I felt like I had to say, I'm an anarchist, you know? I didn't know what else or really how else. I didn't have enough vocabulary to explain that more thoughtfully and thoroughly to somebody yet.
How would you say it now?
I would want to find a specific issue within the political sphere to connect with somebody on. And I would not... if somebody said, are you a Republican or a Democrat? I don't know what I would do there. But I would try to avoid labels altogether. Yeah. And I would say, I've learned, or you know, even I've had this experience, or I read... I think there's lots of less threatening ways to approach somebody than to say, I'm an anarchist.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's the same thing with atheists, right? With religious-minded people, right?
Yeah.
So how do you open the door in the emotional realm so that they can be receptive to truth, you know, to objectivity? But there is, you know, maybe some shock value, I guess, in like Bill Buport's line of like, I'm an abolitionist. I don't believe in human slavery. What form of human slavery do you believe in?
That's pretty confronting.
Yeah, but as an abolitionist, I think that's a useful way to look at it, that you want to abolish the nature of coercion in our society. You know, and how does that manifest itself today? It gets the mind thinking about, well, what's the nature of slavery? What does that mean? We still have it. It's in a different form, but it is nonetheless slavery.
What if you started with, I'm rational. I try to be consistent and universalize what I say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Instead of I'm a Republican or Democrat or an anarchist, and just because you could work through from there.
Sure.
That sounds reasonable.
So this is the means by which I reach conclusions.
Exactly.
And let's talk about the application of those means to a particular conclusion. Yeah. So yeah.
Collaborate with them instead of debate, maybe, and try to understand, because what we're going to be talking about is, you know, these things that everyone's experienced, and this is why, you know, you're talking to a most likely a traumatized person, you know, have emotional empathy for that and, you know, work with them. Hey, this is going to help your life. You're going to be more rational. You're going to be able to figure things out. You're going to be able to predict things better,
not be so defensive.
Yeah, let's right? work, let's just work together
and rigid
right
about
let's,
ideas.
Let's work together and be rational and consistent. We'll use that as our what we're going to point to, so we can discuss and collaborate and work together over a long period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we get into what we do want to do, I wanted to finish up with one more note about your show and how you two guys came to be in the studio today. Was it the end of last year that you had put together this or began to work on this trauma series?
I did a 4-part series on trauma. That was kind of like I ended the show, but then I came across a video that Nathaniel Brandon did talking about romantic love, and it was really heartfelt. I appreciated his perspective. I'd never seen the video before, so
it's an amazing video.
I put the audio to the video on the show, and I grokked it, and then I came across this book in conversation with a friend of mine, Katie, about the neuroscience behind nonviolent communication and so forth. And that led me to a particular site, a resources page, which led me to a book called Power Under, Nonviolent Social Change, I think, subtitle.
Yeah.
But it's written by a guy who's basically leftist, but yet his understanding of trauma and how it affects society and how it's so entrenched in family systems and various other systems was just really incisive, to the point where it's like, I need to actually talk about this book on the show before I end it, you know, to end with a trauma series, which is the deepest level, the foundation from which all of the things that we see in our world, our culture, spring, you know? I mean, you asked a question earlier, like, can we relate trauma to people's lack of curiosity or their ideas that don't comport with the truth?
Yeah.
You know, and I think trauma does underlie all of those mental processes, because we learn how to use our minds in a family system. Are our minds valued? Are they respected? Are we treated with kindness? You know, are we understood? Are we safe? Are our boundaries safe? Are we transgressed? You know, I mean, all those things play into the efficacy and worth of ourselves, the feeling of efficacy of our minds and the worth of our persons. And that's the core of Brandon's work as well, the self-esteem. That need is so important for us as conceptual beings, because we need to really value our minds in order to figure things out, in order to understand a world, make things comprehensible, think rationally. And the feeling of being worthy of happiness is related to emotions. Like, how do we feel about ourselves? How do we feel about others? How do we relate to them in a compassionate way, or a real morally judgmental way? Like, you can't escape the nature of judgment, but you can focus on needs-based judgment, which is the opposite, essentially, of moralistic judgment.
Right.
So I did a whole series on nonviolent communication. I think it was like 12 parts. And that was really instrumental in me understanding more of the emotional side of how it relates to the cognitive processes and how we acquire ideas and keep ideas and develop new ideas that are consistent with, you know, logical clarity.
That emotional side, that psychological side, that's the really challenging work to do, to look at yourself in that level of detail. Mm-hmm. And it can be very challenging and very painful. And you guys talked about that in the last episode you did in the trauma series. And I think that it was you who said, there was a great line, the hardest thing to look at is yourself. It's kind of what we've been talking about with, you know, getting away from ourselves with maybe some of these other, I mean, the world is plenty effed up. So there's plenty to distract us. There's plenty of places to put critical attention.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being in a particularly difficult time for me personally, like summer of 2013. And I had this revolutionary idea that I was going to improve myself and grow entirely through behavioral changes, you know. And anytime since then that I've had an emotional challenge, before I heard, you know, the work that you did on trauma, I said, well, I've been behaving so well. So it kind of shows like what I was taught, right? Psychologically, what I absorbed about psychology and conditioning just from the school and family experience. But why would a bad thing happen to me? I'm behaving so good.
Yeah, you know? And I'm thinking so well. That's another thing. Like, cognitive behavioral therapy is, you know, the most validated empirically, and yet it can lend itself to not really going into the emotional stuff so much. I think it needs to be. There's actually a trauma-focused CBT, which I think is really helpful.
There's also rational emotive behavior therapy.
Yeah, which Ellis is.
Yeah, which Albert Ellis goes a step beyond just standard cognitive behavioral therapy, where rational emotive behavior therapy, right? Here we are in therapy because our behavior has caused some kind of problem in life, or it's caused us some kind of turmoil. Our behavior is caused by emotions, and we're going to look at those things. We're going to examine those things so we can think about them rationally, you know? Mm-hmm. That is very complex. I think we're going to talk about a lot of different ways to do that today. But I mean, how do you feel about REBT versus CBT?
Well, I have studied Ellis a bit, and I know he had a debate with Brandon back in the day a few decades ago. We might have actually talked about that on the show.
Maybe in passing, yeah.
Yeah, he was a bit irascible, shall we say. I mean, he had a principle with his clients, which was PYA. I want you to PYA, Matt. Push your ass. Yeah. Don't just sit there. Do something.
Let's go.
Which is contrary to...
Let's go heal your trauma.
What I've heard in the NVC circles, which is don't just do something. Sit there. Sit there.
Sure.
Pause. Take time in. Really attune to your emotions. Find out what's alive in you. Where's this stuff coming from? You know?
Yeah. And you think Ellis neglects...
I think there was definitely some authoritarian elements in his style. Yeah, where as opposed to the Rogerian method, Carl Rogers, which was all about empathetic connection, right?
Sure.
Believing in the client's capacity to evolve, to self discover.
Yeah.
And to really get attuned to themselves so that they could, in a sense, reparent themselves. Because what makes it so hard to talk about the emotional stuff is the vulnerability aspect as children. What happens when we're a child and we're vulnerable and, for instance, we get punished or we get abused or we get neglected, you know? Then the capacity to be vulnerable about our emotions is really stunted.
Yeah.
You know? And the IFS model, of course, looks at it from the standpoint of these protector parts of self that take the fore and render that suffering child is an exile in our mind. And those parts stay exiled until those protectors step aside and allow that vulnerability to happen. And whether you have friends that you can be vulnerable with, or a lover, a partner, or just people that you relate to in like a group, you know, that are really attuned to empathetic connection, like an NVC practice group, for instance, that is really conducive to reliving the experience as a child where you can be vulnerable and it's okay. You're not going to get shut down or abused or berated or made fun of. Nothing like that.
Right.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I didn't get a lot of emotional training as a child.
Me neither.
And I was going to ask, like, it's kind of how our brain values things. And as children, we're scared, and you know, if we hear yelling in the house, and we feel these emotions, and we don't know how to process them. I mean, that's Molly and I spend most of our time helping our kids process their emotions, and she's really good at it.
Which is helping yourselves process your emotions, I would imagine.
Right, and we heard earlier about cognitive empathy versus a more feeling-based empathy. And I thought that was interesting because we were talking before the show, and I go, wow, I've never made that distinction before. And so, yeah, that's where my mind was going, Brett, with getting more emotional intelligence, getting more feeling-based emotions or feeling-based empathy.
Like emotional attunement to really hearing you're feeling distressed, and I'm feeling, you know, the sense of that rather than just identifying, oh, you're feeling distressed.
The kids, they don't necessarily want the intellectual answer. They want to feel emotionally like that you understand where they are emotionally. Our children could tell right away is our face into it. Like, you know, like before we even say anything.
Yeah. Are you really there? Are you really present with me?
Right.
Are you hearing me and understanding what I'm saying? What's coming out? Right. So that need for visibility that I'm here, I matter.
Yeah.
My feelings matter. And that gets into the questions that Nathaniel Brandon posed in various books he has, you know, Honoring the Self and Breaking Free. And I think the six pillars, he lists them in there as well. And I think they're really instructive for the kind of interaction with parents that we could have had, we can have, if we focus on this knowledge. You know, and that's kind of the purpose of doing a series on trauma. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, the last in the series that we did, because you relate it to the practical elements of what's going on in your life and your family system. And some of the challenges and all the enriching aspects of this process. Because, I mean, it can be a real downer to realize how much trauma is playing a role in our lives and how much it affected us as children.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a reason why those parts are exiled early on. Because it's scary, it's painful, it's confusing.
And that brings us to our goals today, right? So we're going to go through the adverse childhood experiences questions. We're going to score ourselves in front of the audience, you know, and we're going to encourage them to do the same so they have this information. But I think we're also going to discuss using the things you just mentioned, Brandon's questions from Breaking Free, some of the exercises in this book, The Art of Self-Discovery, also by Brandon, ways to supplement the initial investigation we might do of ourselves or our childhoods through the ACEs test. So ways we could better build out some knowledge of that past experience. Then I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, once we have these numbers, what can we do? And we've previewed that pretty nicely so far. But there's a phrase that, what's his name, Peter Gerlach, mm-hmm. breaking the cycle,
yeah.
right? How do we break the cycle? There's a lot of young parents in my audience who are probably at some point along the way in this struggle and maybe asking a lot of these same questions, or people planning to be parents. And, you know, there was another questionnaire that we came across, the resilience, what's your resilience score mm-hmm. for ACEs? And you said it left a little bit to be desired. But I thought it was at least a way of kind of thinking about, well, these were the answers for me. How would I be if I was in this situation as a parent? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most important discussions in our resilience is going to be this book by Bessel van der Kolk. Is
that yes.
called
The Body Keeps the Score.
The Body Keeps the Score. So that's what we're planning to do today. And I thought we could start with a little grammar on the ACEs, where it came from and what exactly it is. And then we'll get into the questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, adverse childhood experiences. You know, that is this study that was done by a collaboration between Kaiser Permanente in San Diego and the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. Which is a nice government bureaucracy, right?
You know, this is about as far out into the mainstream as we yeah. can push this conversation that the three
exactly.
of us have been having for the
and
last
consider
30
it
minutes.
At all credible, right? Yeah,
exactly. Right.
Yeah, but Felitti, I think, was the lead researcher at Kaiser, and they were doing a weight loss program for people, and it turned out like half of the people there defected from it, even though they were losing weight, and they wanted to know what was going on, so they sent this survey of questions, and it turned out there was a high correlation between the adverse childhood experiences that these people had and later disease and illness and, you know, problems with their lives. And so, Matt, if you have anything
yeah,
more
I mean,
to
I,
add.
Like a lot of incredible science that has been created over the years, they started off looking at something else, noticed something, and this doctor had a epiphany and started to see that a lot of these people that were dropping out of the weight loss program that were doing well, that was scaring them in some way. And they all were sexually abused and they were using this weight probably to protect themselves. So he took that and made what is now the ACE study. And it's an incredible study that is conducted by accident. And it's great for us because it's a mainstream study that should blow everyone's mind. It did mine when I heard it about this needs to stop. I mean, what can we do to stop this craziness that's going on, that's affecting these people for the rest of their lives? And I still remember where I was when I heard it on Steph's show for the first time. These statistics, blew my mind, and I hope the people that are listening to this will have a similar reaction and take to heart what we're about to say and what we're about to reveal about it. If you haven't heard about the ACE study,
mm-hmm. So like some of the things, the ailments, even cancer and heart disease, not to mention suicide. I mean, as you go up the ACE score. In terms of the ones, I mean, there's basically five that are personal regarding physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, and emotional neglect. And then five, there's 10 total. So then the other five are related to other family members, a parent who's an alcoholic, a mother who's a victim of domestic violence, a family member in jail, a family member diagnosed with a mental illness, and the disappearance of a parent through divorce, death, or abandonment. So all those things are traumatic experiences for children because we want to survive, right? We want to feel safe. and we want to be respected and understood and empathized with. And a lot of those needs get thrown by the wayside when we're in a family system that is really dysfunctional, that hasn't focused on the self-knowledge stuff. And so how can we focus on the self-knowledge stuff, make that appealing for people so that they don't keep on repeating the cycle of what they experienced?
And right when children need all this empathy, all of this attunement, all of this teaching from these big giants who are their parents, they're getting the exact opposite. They're getting yelled at. They're witnessing horrific acts in the house. Sometimes they're being sexually abused much more than I would have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely confusing to them. It's terribly stressful for them. And it rewires their brain, sometimes with effects that, well, we're seeing here that last a lifetime.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that even if none of those things are going on, it's completely been normalized that once they turn age six, they're going to be carted off to another domination system where they're going to spend, they'll get a few breaks, but they're going to spend 15,000 hours of their lives in pretty formative years there, you know? And I remember, like, I was prepared to go to school, you know, and they start you off harmlessly enough in nursery school and then kindergarten. But I remember like getting off the bus, going in there for the first day in 1983. I was like, this is life now. This is awful. Remember we read that article like in the first education show we did? It was like from The Onion about the boy who's realizing. And it's done.
Exactly.
But it was like a real crisis for me. I was like, this is what life is going to. I don't know if the realization was that clear to me, but I remember it was like halfway through the first day of school in 1983, first grade. And I just started to like weep.
Yeah.
You know, like it's fucking over, man. This is it. And it didn't get much better. I mean, I got used to it.
Yeah.
The experience never really improved. Like by the time you enter first grade, kind of the golden days of fun at school are behind you. You know, it's really kindergarten. It's how they get you. And elementary school is not terrible compared to what comes next. Man, this is dark, huh? Because like middle school is worse than that. And high school is all this additional pressure where you can at least, like we've said on the show before, at least you can see the end of the tunnel and at least you're becoming an adult and you're feeling more independent and efficacious. So even if we don't see those dramatic things that add up to a high ACEs score, everyone is sent off. 90% of children spanked, last statistics I saw. I don't know, maybe one of you guys know how many children are put into some kind of church setting where, you know, the whole rewards and punishment thing is reinforced in some really scary ways with ideas of like going to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
And school. That's 95%+ of, you know, the population of kids in this country.
And what's crazy, truly crazy, is, and I'm glad they didn't have the drugs they do now. You know, I still remember my first days in school, and you know, I was blowing on my arm. I was when the teacher would walk outside, I'd go up to the front and mimic them and make everyone laugh and have fun. And I was sent to the principal more times than, you know, I think I set a record. You know, now they would drug you. They would, you know, and now a lot of the kids that are you know, that have quote-unquote behavioral problems, that's abuse. And so you're taking these kids that have these traumatic experiences that we're going to get into and are unable to process reality, really, because they're misattuned, because they've received the exact opposite from their parents what they should be getting. And now the response of the school is to drug them.
It's amazing the fact that they give these drugs to little kids because of so-called behavior problems, not looking at all the factors in play, including the domination system that they're in, which essentially denies their capacity for choice and autonomy and respect. I mean, all kinds of things are just completely sacrificed with the schooling system, the model itself. And this is seen as normal and actually beneficial by a lot of these trauma researchers, which is doubly disturbing because you'd think that if anyone has this stuff in terms of domination on the radar screen, it is the people that work in the trauma research realm.
Wasn't there a question on the international ACEs Like, there's an international version of this, because obviously yes. there's been the recognition that people outside of the United States deal with some more...
They do exist, and yeah. they do have problems.
And, exactly. And perhaps some more complex problems than we have to deal with here in, mm-hmm. in some cases, especially politically. And one of the questions that would get you a mark that would raise your score is, were you denied the opportunity to go to school?
Yeah. Was there like civil strife in your community and you weren't able to go to school?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they see going to school as a beneficial thing rather than talking about education, access to learning, you know, being able to learn, being able to direct your own learning process. Like that seems to be off the radar screen of the people that are in these institutions of education or schooling. And it's just terribly unfortunate.
Oh, yeah, it's a binary choice like carrots and sticks. Did you go to school or did you not get an education?
Yeah. And so what does that reveal in those questions? A lack of trust in the child to actually guide themselves in the learning process. It's like that's not their responsibility. That's the responsibility of teachers to tell them what to do, what to study, what to learn for the test. You know, all that stuff is just extrinsic motivators.
Yeah.
And it really diminishes the intrinsic motivation of children that they have. Inherently, we all have this, you know, to really flourish.
Oh, what an enormous problem, the lack of trust.
Yeah, but in these institutions, and even a lot of the researchers, Peter Gerlach has said that many of these people in these types of service organizations have a lot of trauma in their history and are there because of that reason, most likely.
You mean in those?
Yeah, like teachers and you know, the people that you're talking about, Wes. The people that are actually doing this research, some of them have themselves you know, a lot of trauma that may preclude them from getting to some of the results that we think mm-hmm. should be gotten.
I think we all probably had experiences with people in school, and my last guest, again, spoke to this a little bit, that people who might have seemed kind of sadistic or like they enjoyed twisting kids in this weird way that was always kind of masked by, ha, 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 this is amusing, but it was also, you know, really cruel and sometimes for the kids really embarrassing. Like I remember being embarrassed in school numerous times or shamed in front of an entire group, or the teacher, I talked about this too, recruiting my peers to shame me, you know, for not paying attention, those kinds of things. The story wow. I told in the last show, if neither of you have heard it, is, you know, I wouldn't pay attention in like seventh grade math class because I had drawings that I wanted to do. Drawing was awesome. Math sucked.
You were a doodler, huh?
I was not. No. No, 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 no. I was not a doodler.
Oh, these were epic drawings.
I was a goddamn architect.
This is an architect. You're building societies.
I was. I was doing
cityscapes.
Like, I was doing like landscape. Oh, I had learned like vanishing point drawings and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing like architect, like buildings and stadiums and landscape architecture. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I was serious. And when teachers would come and they'd just grab stuff off your desk. Like I remember in seventh grade, like in the middle of just this epic. I don't remember what it was, but I remember two pieces of paper had been taped together.
Uh-huh.
And she just came off my desk and grabbed it and ripped it up right in front, or just scrunched it up right in front of me. And I was like, what the fuck? It was like four hours of my time and just gone like
and
that.
And if you'd have done that to her work that she was doing, what do you think the punishment would have been?
Different.
Right? Different. Totally different.
Different than just me sitting there feeling embarrassed.
So why is it in the schooling context that your dignity as a student means less than, or you have less dignity than the teachers or
and
the
that's completely normalized.
It's completely normalized.
It's not so even a question.
Why is it that students and teachers don't have equal dignity in that system?
Well,
it's how it was designed. Yeah. I mean, it's based on distrust in the learning process for people to do it on their own. So you have professionals to teach you how to do things, and you better stay on task, which you weren't, so you're going to get punished and your property is not valuable.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that there was never a time where a teacher would pull you aside or a parent outside of school would take an active interest in saying, what's going on?
Yeah, to really try to connect.
I think we all remember that happening, but we logged 12 years in those relationships, in those sets of expectations, right? But how many memories like that do I have?
I have zero.
Really?
Before college, yeah.
Wow.
Like, I mean, a little bit before you guys, but
yeah.
This, you know, to talk about, hey, how are you feeling about this? Never.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, you're, you could be doing better or worse than this.
Yeah.
But, you know, to have someone, you know, actually be curious about how I'm feeling about something.
Yeah.
That happened in college. I had to take a business writing class. I still remember this teacher. She came up to me. She goes, you know, you're a really good writer, but you're not really applying yourself here. And how are you feeling about when you write? And she, you know, really, I was shocked. I could still remember how shocked I was that she actually asked about my emotions.
Yeah, I don't. How about you? Do you?
No, I agree with Rosenberg. Like he says, I went to school for 12 years. No one ever asked me what I was feeling.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of the MO of the system. Like once it starts peeling that onion, then you're going to see all the discontent, the frustration, the disappointment, you know, the rage.
Oh, my goodness.
At being controlled all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're kind of chipping away at a wall that's holding a lot back.
Yes.
When you start asking questions like that as an adult.
Because feelings are the windows to the needs that are being sacrificed.
So I think it makes sense that those experiences are pretty rare mm-hmm. for the three of us.
And it's really tragic that, you know, NVC trainers sometimes work within these domination schools with teachers to help them practice compassionate communication, to talk about feelings and needs in a domination system, right? Yeah. I think first things first, we need to recognize that this system is not designed for healthy human functioning. So we need to dispense with that, and then we can do the compassionate connection, because then there's going to be authenticity.
All right, that is going to conclude part one. Part two should be out towards the end of this week. In that show, we will go through the ACEs questions and score ourselves. I want to leave you today with a clip of an audiobook that we mentioned briefly, but I think it sets the tone for what we're going to be doing in the rest of these shows. The book is called The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body and the Healing of Trauma by Bessel van der Kolk. And I just want to share with you a summary. A pioneering researcher and one of the world's foremost experts on traumatic stress offers a bold new paradigm for healing. Trauma is a fact of life. Veterans and their families deal with the painful aftermath of combat. 1 in 5 Americans has been molested. 1 in 4 grew up with alcoholics. 1 in 3 couples have engaged in physical violence. Such experiences inevitably leave traces on minds, emotions, and even on biology. Sadly, trauma sufferers frequently pass their stress on to their partners and children. Renowned trauma expert Bessel van der Kolk has spent over 3 decades working with survivors. In The Body Keeps the Score, he transforms our understanding of traumatic stress, revealing how it literally rearranges the brain's wiring, specifically areas dedicated to pleasure, engagement, control, and trust. He shows how these areas can be reactivated through innovative treatments, including neurofeedback, mindfulness techniques, play, yoga, and other therapies. Based on Dr. van der Kolk's own research and that of other leading specialists, The Body Keeps the Score offers proven alternatives to drugs and talk therapy, and a way to reclaim lives. What you're going to hear is a clip from late in the audiobook in a chapter focused on solutions. We will probably include more of this chapter as the series goes on. Thank you for listening and take care.
Chapter 17, Putting the Pieces Together, Self-Leadership. This being human is a guest house. Every morning is a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome, and entertain them all. Treat each guest honorably. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Rumi. A man has as many social selves as there are individuals who recognize him. William James, from The Principles of Psychology. It was early in my career, and I had been seeing Mary, a shy, lonely, and physically collapsed young woman, for about 3 months in weekly psychotherapy, dealing with the ravages of her terrible history of early abuse. One day I opened the door to my waiting room and saw her standing there, provocatively, dressed in a miniskirt, her hair dyed flaming red, with a cup of coffee in one hand and a snarl on her face. "You must be Dr. Vanderkalk," she said. "My name is Jane, and I came to warn you not to believe any of the lies that Mary has been telling you. Can I come in and tell you about her?" I was stunned, but fortunately kept myself from confronting Jane, and instead heard her out. Over the course of our session, I met not only Jane, but also a hurt little girl and an angry male adolescent. That was the beginning of a long and productive treatment. Mary was my first encounter with dissociative identity disorder, known as DID, which at that time was called multiple personality disorder. As dramatic as its symptoms are, the internal splitting and emergence of distinct identities experienced in DID represent only the extreme end of the spectrum of mental life. The sense of being inhabited by warring impulses or parts is common to all of us, but particularly to traumatized people who had to resort to extreme measures in order to survive. Exploring, even befriending, those parts is an important component of healing. Desperate times require desperate measures. We all know what happens when we feel humiliated. We put all our energy into protecting ourselves, developing whatever survival strategies we can. We may repress our feelings. We may get furious and plot revenge. We may decide to become so powerful and successful that nobody can ever hurt us again. Many behaviors that are classified as psychiatric problems, including some obsessions, compulsions, and panic attacks, as well as most self-destructive behaviors, started out as strategies for self-protection. These adaptations to trauma can so interfere with the capacity to function that healthcare providers and patients themselves often believe that full recovery is beyond reach. Viewing these symptoms as permanent disabilities narrows the focus of treatment to finding the proper drug regimen, which can lead to lifelong dependence, as though trauma survivors were like kidney patients on dialysis. It's much more productive to see aggression or depression, arrogance or passivity as learned behaviors. Somewhere along the line, the patient came to believe that he or she can survive only if he or she was tough, invisible, or absent, or that it was safer to give up. Like traumatic memories that keep intruding until they are laid to rest, traumatic adaptations continue until the human organism feels safe and integrates all the parts of itself that are stuck in fighting or warding off the trauma. Every trauma survivor I've met is resilient in his or her own way, and every one of their stories inspires awe at how people cope. Knowing how much energy the sheer act of survival requires keeps me from being surprised at the price they often pay: the absence of a loving relationship with their own bodies, minds, and souls. Coping takes its toll. For many children, it's safer to hate themselves than to risk their relationship with their caregivers by expressing anger or by running away. As a result, abused children are likely to grow up believing that they are fundamentally unlovable. That was the only way their young minds could explain why they were treated so badly. They survive by denying, ignoring, and splitting off large chunks of reality. They forget the abuse. They suppress their rage or despair. They numb their physical sensations. If you were abused as a child, you are likely to have a childlike part living inside you that is frozen in time, still holding fast to this kind of self-loathing and denial. Many adults who survive terrible experiences are caught in the same trap. Pushing away intense feelings can be highly adaptive in the short run. It may help you preserve your dignity and independence. It may help you maintain focus on critical tasks like saving a comrade, taking care of your kids, or rebuilding your house. The problems come later. After seeing a friend blown up, a soldier may return to civilian life and try to put the experience out of his mind. A protective part of him knows how to be competent at his job and how to get along with colleagues, but he may habitually erupt in rage at his girlfriend or become numb and frozen when the pleasure of surrendering to her touch makes him feel he is losing control. He probably will not be aware that his mind automatically associates passive surrender with the paralysis he felt when his friend was killed. So another protective part steps in to create a diversion. He gets angry, and having no idea what set him off, he thinks he's mad about something his girlfriend did. Of course, if he keeps blowing up at her, and subsequent girlfriends, he will become more and more isolated. But he may never realize that a traumatized part is triggered by passivity, and that another part, an angry manager, is stepping in to protect that vulnerable part. Helping these parts give up their extreme beliefs is how therapy can save people's lives. As we saw in Chapter 13, a central task for recovery from trauma is to learn to live with the memories of the past without being overwhelmed by them in the present. But most survivors, including those who are functioning well, even brilliantly, in some aspects of their lives, face another even greater challenge: reconfiguring a brain-mind system that was constructed to cope with the worst. Just as we need to revisit traumatic memories in order to integrate them, we need to revisit the parts of ourselves that developed the defensive habits that helped us to survive.